Angus, thanks very much indeed. Now, you're very welcome to the late debate. Well, a little later on, we're going to be talking about the government's record in office since they took over almost this day 4 years ago. First, though, Jimmy Deanahan was in the Shannon earlier this evening presenting Ireland's diaspora policy. They say it's the first clear statement of the government of Ireland on the diaspora. It's estimated that nearly a quarter of a million people left Ireland during the downturn and that there are up to 70 million people worldwide who would claim to be part of the Irish diaspora. Well, this document talks about supporting the diaspora, about connecting with them, about recognising them. But what concretely is it actually going to do? Well, I'm joined now by Professor Alan Barrett from the ESRI, by Senator Mark Daly, the Fine Gael spokesperson on the diaspora, by Bernard Durkin from Fine Gael, who's deputy chair of the Oireachtas Foreign Affairs Committee, by Mary Claire McAleer from the National Youth Council of Ireland, and by Hugh O'Connell, who is political editor of the Journal. You're all very welcome, and thank you all very much indeed for coming into us this evening. Mark, I'll go to you first. Were you there in the Shannon this evening as Minister Jimmy Deanahan outlined or laid out what this policy is all about?
Well, I was, and I'm delighted to be the first person to be appointed by any political party as a spokesperson for the diaspora, and amazingly enough, the first person to ever produce a policy paper by any political party in the history of the state on the diaspora in 2013. And then Eamon Gilmore came out with the idea that there should be a minister for the diaspora.
So moving on to this, which is the first official document, what was your reaction to it? What is your reaction to it?
It lacks any clear objectives, and I'll give you the most disappointing part of it from the Irish living overseas, those who have left in the last number of years, the 800,000 Irish citizens who have passports, who were born in this country and are living throughout the world, is the fact that this government have failed to give a commitment that they will give them the vote. The most basic right of any citizen of any state is have the right to a vote.
And but isn't that something that the minister did look into, but that it was just too
complex?
Well,
Jimmy said that he was in favour of it, but when it came out in the policy, they said, we'll look at it into the future. They had this great line, there are technical and legal difficulties. Well, I got to say, that's like stating the obvious. Of course there are technical and legal difficulties, but just look at where we are. There's 196 countries in the world, and of those, 120 can afford their citizens who are living overseas the vote. Ireland is one of only four countries in the Council of Europe, of 33 countries, that does not give its citizens overseas the vote.
And who would you recommend that we give the vote to? I mean, as you see, there are up to 70 million claiming.
Well, I don't think we'll extend it to 70 million. And it's also, where do you extend the vote to? I don't think it's practical in the Dáil, but you could have done it in a reform. Shannon, in a presidential election, obviously would be a case. And we have a unique and peculiar situation where if you're giving every citizen outside of the state a vote, that includes the North. So you have 800,000 passport holders who are living outside of the island of Ireland. And then you have, you know, 1.2 million people who are living up in the six counties who would also be entitled to have a vote. So how you manage that is very important, but it is the most basic and fundamental right of any citizen. And I don't think there's any better way we could celebrate 2016 than saying, you know what, every citizen is entitled to a vote. Now, if they can do it in Africa and they can do it in the Pacific Oceans on small little islands, they can do it in Ireland.
Bernard Durkin.
Well, I think, first of all, Jimmy Deanahan, Minister Jimmy Deanahan, is the first minister for the diaspora in this country. I think it's a very progressive step. I think it is long past the time for giving recognition to the diaspora. I disagree with Mark. I think it is benchmarking insofar as legislation is concerned.
That's a bad word, Bernard.
Well, it might be bad for you guys, but we won't go there. The reality of it is this, the issue is simply this, that for far too long we have had the issue of the diaspora. We never really recognised them. And this is recognition. And when I was in the previous incarnation as Minister for State, I went and I met them, not at St. Patrick's Day, but at a different time of the year. And I found, on a one-to-one basis, you were able to glean from them their feeling of being a little bit left alone and feeling that they were no longer important.
Wouldn't the ultimate recognition, though, be to give them the vote? I mean, why isn't that?
There are a number of ways you can do that. There are a number of ways, and again, Mark knows this quite well, that you can do it. You don't need a reform sense. In actual fact, that can be done in any event. The Senate is a legislature. It's not a place really for just going through the motions.
So you could give the vote.
Well, you could.
So why didn't you?
Well, that's a work in progress. We haven't
it's
discounted
not really,
anything. Well, I was listening to the debate this evening, just as well as you were, in actual fact, and obviously gleaned a bit more from it, because during the course of that debate, you were busy congratulating the minister and you couldn't say enough to compliment him for all the work
he's
he's done.
He's a nice fellow.
And
man,
I am surprised. I am surprised that you didn't say the same thing
here. Of course, he's a nice fellow.
After all, the folks back home in Kerry would be listening to you and they'd be waiting to hear you come out with this and say, praising Jimmy. I think the praise is well.
Let's get back to the voter, Bernard.
Going back to the voter.
Are there any concrete proposals as, you know, we're looking at?
Well, they have been looked at. They have been looked at because the Constitutional Convention looked at this idea. The European Union has looked, yes. And the European Union has looked at this idea. The implementation of it requires a little bit more consideration than just applying it.
And is there a timetable for that?
Well, there isn't. It's in the course of the debate that takes place now as a result of this particular policy. Remember, this policy produced by government. This hasn't been done before. This is the first time.
Well, absolutely,
the first time
there's
for
so
everything.
Many firsts in it, but the vote is a very key issue. In fact, do you know what? I think, have we got Jenny on the line there at the moment? No, we're going to be speaking to Jenny in London.
Can I just kick in on this?
Very much. Yes. No, just, Keelan, can I just ask? Oh, sorry, Alan. Yeah,
yeah, no, it's, I mean, you're talking about the vote, but I have to say, if I think about the diaspora, and it's a bit like if you think of people, you know, living in the Republic of Ireland, I mean, I think our responsibility should be those who are sort of the most disadvantaged. And the thing about the Irish diaspora, it's a very, very sort of, you know, complex and heterogeneous group of people. There's some people who are doing extremely well. But the real worry, I think, that, you know, and the real group of people we need to help are the people, particularly who went in the 1950s, mm-hmm. also a group who went in the 1980s. Bernard and Mark have probably both, you know, met these sort of groups of people. But they are the, you know, the guys and the women who did particularly badly, really, really suffered, and are now living in pretty dire circumstances outside of this country. A lot of them sort of, not only do they feel sort of disconnected, they feel they can't come back. There's the shame and the embarrassment, because again, you know, a lot of emigrant stories are normally the ones about success. Those are the ones we hear about an awful lot. And I have to say, in terms of the sort of the policy, there's a whole range of things in it. But if there was to be progress on a particular issue, it would be to actually look after the people in, you know, throughout the United Kingdom in particular, with mental health difficulties, you know, physical health difficulties.
But aren't there commitments
about
this type of
thing
here, Alan?
I mean, I have to say,
multi-annual grants, they mention mental health, increase the focus on mental health.
They do, and I think that's the sort of thing that's really about. But for me, that's actually the big issue. I mean, the issue of votes, you know, might be nice, it might be appropriate. There are huge difficulties with it. But I think, you know, in terms of what should this state actually be doing, in the same way that we should really be looking after people domestically who need our help most, I really think we should be focusing our efforts.
But I'm sure there are many people who were forced to emigrate in recent years mm-hmm. who would very keenly want to be able to vote because they want to come home. They were forced out.
All I'm saying is that I think there's a hierarchy of issues. Okay, but if I was talking to Jimmy Dean now and I said, you know, what is the one thing in your document, because it's about, you know, 90 or 100 pages, what is the one thing you would like to say? And again, it sort of goes back to the notion of 1916, 20s, you know, this notion we were supposed to cherish all the children. Now, these are people who are, you know, they're old people now, but I just think looking after this group is the best thing we could do.
Hugh O'Connor, you want to come in?
One of the things I think about the document, though, is that just if you compare it to something else which the government has introduced over the last few years, the Action Plan for Jobs. Now, that has very tangible targets in terms of creating employment, and it's much criticised and it's kind of ridiculed in the media to some extent because it's, you know, always achieving 95% success rates. But what it has done is created employment in this country, and you can see that in terms of the amount of jobs being created, unemployment has dropped. But in the diaspora document, there doesn't seem to be anything in terms of tangible targets, like we're going to reach this level of engagement with this amount of Irish citizens abroad over the next few years, from my understanding of it. So, you know, I think that that's one of the things that it lacks.
More of a PR exercise.
Well, it seems that way from reading it and having gone to the press conference, and Bernard's shaking his head here, but having gone to the press conference, there was a lot of talk about things that we want to kind of do over the next few years. But I mean, when you talk about the issue which we're all kind of talking about tonight in terms of votes for the diaspora, there's nothing in terms of a timetable or when we're going to get this done or, you know, how it's going to work. And don't forget, we're only talking about votes for presidential elections. We're not even talking about the idea of electing TDs or senators or things like that, which is something that other countries do as a matter of course.
Well, Jenny McShannon is on the line now. She is the CEO of Irish in Britain. She's based in London. And just to let you know, the text number here, if you want to get involved in this debate, is 51551. Jenny, thank you for taking our call this evening. We were speaking there just a little earlier about the issue of the vote. We'll talk about that in a moment. But first of all, just tell us, you're working with Irish emigrants in London. You're working with people who would have left in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. What is the circumstance in which these people are finding themselves at the moment? How important is this document to them?
Well, the document is really important. I think the first thing to acknowledge is that the diaspora of all generations is very diverse. So there are those who of that age group who have been very successful and are living, you know, great lives. But there are others who have come to Britain, made their lives, raised their families. They've often worked in very difficult industries, and particularly those in the pre-pension and just sort of early post-pension age group, who have very high levels of life-limiting illness, very poor health, a sort of culture of resilience and reluctance to access healthcare services, and therefore leaving it until it's too late. So there's a lot of health inequalities, and there's a lot of insular in sense of community that's quite insular.
And what do you see in this document that addresses that? I mean, if you look at the section on supporting the diaspora, they talk about keeping welfare at the heart of our approach to the diaspora. There is a move to multi-annual grants, but is it concrete enough, Jenny, from what you see?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the immigrant support programme has been going on for some years. I think that as the those migrants who are leaving now, the young Irish who are leaving now, are very different. Their demographic, their experiences, their opportunities are very different. There has been a degree of anxiety about will the immigrant support programme still respond to the needs of the older community. A little bit of assumption that maybe the oldest have now died, and actually that's not the case. The immigrant support programme is really important. So for us, looking at the diaspora, at the Global Irish document and the strategy, it's very important that the immigrant support programme is right at the heart of it. And multi-annual funding is probably the biggest step forward that we've seen in the last 10 years.
And in terms of the vote issue, what was your reaction to the fact that that was not included in this, despite it having been recommended by the Constitutional Convention and having been asked for by many people?
Well, I think whilst we applaud what we consider a very positive document, we were at the very least disappointed and frustrated and angry that it wasn't included. It is, throughout the consultations, it's been a constant refrain. For the older generation, the presidential vote has been really important to them. For the younger generation, the vote in, you know, and broader representation in the Dáil and the Oireachtas is hugely important to them. So it's annoying, it's frustrating. It was recommended in the Constitutional Convention. It was recommended in the report in December by the Joint Oireachtas Committee in Europe. It feels like the conversation started, a lot of people meeting with the Minister of the Diaspora, Jimmy Deanahan, talking about it, it being acknowledged in the Immigrant Support Programme Review, which was launched in January or December, and again being acknowledged in this report, and no clear concrete steps for it. People are frustrated and fed up.
Okay, well, listen, Jenny McShannon, thank you very much indeed for taking our call this evening. Bernard, you can hear it there from somebody at the cold face that this is enormously disappointing that not only has the vote not been included in the document, but there is no clear pathway to giving the vote to our immigrants.
Well, as I said, it's work in progress. I think that that will happen eventually. To what extent and what the structure of the voting will take, it's impossible to tell at this stage. But the intention is, and
the minister indicated that you would put out a document when you can say that, but one of the key parts of this document, it is impossible to tell what it may or may not look like, or we may or may not do it.
He mentioned that in the time available, it wasn't possible to do all the things that he wanted to do. He also said that certain aspects might need a constitutional change, which would mean a referendum. And he said that that would not take place in the life of this Dáil, but it would more than likely take place in the next Dáil. And
Mary Claire, let me bring Mary Claire McAleer in here. I suppose you represent some of the younger voters who have gone.
Absolutely. And
abroad.
I think, you know, we published research on the issue of youth emigration 2 years ago. And at that time, I think that there was an absence of discussion about the realities of emigration, the impact that it had, particularly on young people, but right across society. So I think this document really, we welcome it and we see it as a framework to build upon. I think that both the appointment of a minister for the diaspora and a policy response is something that the emigrants that participated in our study were looking for. The issue of voting emigrants, as Jenny mentioned, it's disappointing. It's disappointing because many emigrants have spoken about it, and there's a very strong lobby for voting. But I don't see it as off the table. I think that the document that was published highlights some of the challenges that I think the political system need to address. And we certainly would welcome it, those issues being interrogated further. And maybe it won't happen in the lifetime of this government, but I think it is an issue that, because I think, you know, there was a stage where this issue, you know, there was a dominance about a discussion about whether people were leaving because they had to or they chose to. Now we're actually talking about the challenges that are existing. And yes,
but it is interesting, Marie-Claire. I mean, already in our text line is 51551. All we're hearing is, you know, I'll give you an idea of it here. The idea of the diaspora telling those who live here what rules they must live under is grossly unfair. Mm-hmm. No representation without taxation. That's a listener called Patrick. Mm-hmm. Another one, Padder, says if the Irish diaspora want to vote, then they should make a financial contribution to the recovery of the country. Mm-hmm. If they prefer not to, then they should get involved in local politics in their new countries instead of trying to govern Ireland by remote control. So
I think
it's not clear cut that there's support within this country, I suppose, for it.
Well, you know, when I look at the UCC study that was also published 2 years ago, they asked the Irish population would they support votes for emigrants in presidential elections, and I think it was around 79% of respondents said that they would be in favour of it. And I think, you know, I don't want to get detracted with the issue of votes. I think this document is valuable because it's the first time that we've actually had a document that looks at pre and post departure supports for emigrants, and it also looks at the most vulnerable, but it looks at, you know, some of the barriers to return. And from the Youth Council's perspective, yes, we've seen young people leaving in very significant numbers. We know that a significant proportion are highly skilled and highly educated. Some left because they wanted to, but there are many who would like to return. And as we see the economy beginning to improve, I think that it's really important that the government acts to put in place some sort of package to support and facilitate that return and address some of those barriers.
Alan, if I can bring you in here, I mean, let's just step back for a moment. I suppose this whole diaspora document really is addressing the culture, the history of emigration we've had in this country, going back centuries really at this point. But in recent years, just tell us about the extent of emigration we saw since the downturn and what economically that has cost us. Well, in pros and cons, I mean, it took people off the live register, but it also took a lot of the education we had paid for out of the country.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the most recent year you're looking at sort of a net outflow of about sort of 35,000. So, you know, obviously in any year there's inflows and outflows, but there is an outflow of about 80,000. So, there has been, I think, maybe a sort of better quarter of a million people actually did leave over the course of the downturn. But, I mean, you posed the question in terms of what the costs were. I have a slightly different perspective on this. I mean, the problem was the Irish economy tanked. Demand for labour went down dramatically, and so there were no jobs at that time available for those people. So, I mean, their outflow was merely a symptom of the problem. I don't think it was, in a sense, you know, part of the problem. So the outflow happened. Now, I'm going to be really, really clear. Emigration is a terrible, terrible thing, and forced emigration is just an awful thing, and it's emotionally terribly troubling for people. But in many ways, given that the jobs were not here, the individuals were probably better off being somewhere else, keeping their skills alive rather than sort of, you know, staying, you know, on the dole in Ireland. And so when if this discussion was happening in Portugal and Spain to a certain extent, countries where there's a much, you know, less of a likelihood that people actually emigrate, there they're talking about lost generations and stuff like that. The great thing about Irish kids, okay, you know, is that at least they do go away. They maintain their connection with the labour market. And then, of course, over time then, the hope is, and history has shown this, again, we're taking a historical perspective tonight, you know, there was a huge outflow in the 1950s, there was an inflow in the 1960s, there was a huge outflow in the 80s, there was an inflow in the 1990s. The hope now, and I think we're seeing it a little bit already, is that although there was the significant outflow, the hope is that these people are now coming back again. So I don't see it in terms of loss. And just one last point before I hand over again, the evidence on this is actually, you know, people who go away and come back again actually tend to do better on the labour market.
That's
than
a very interesting piece of research, isn't it? They get better paid. Yeah.
Well, we did it twice, actually. I did it on a data set in the 1980s and a data set in the 2000s, where we compared people who had gone away for a number of years and then came back to Ireland. And so you're looking at comparable, you know, they're the same in every respect, except some of them lived away, you know, comparing them to the people who stayed. And there is a wage premium, okay, of about 7 to 15% per annum for having worked outside of Ireland. And it's, you know, these are very, very large data sets. And I think it makes sense. Clearly, I think what it says is the Irish labour market actually rewards foreign experience. Now, it's of course nicer if people just opt to get that. You don't want to see people forced into that position. But the notion that emigration is a big cause, like, I mean, the problem and the cause is all about the economic downturn. Emigration
and
is then, emigration is then
it.
Just, yeah, but there are certainly benefits to the individuals.
Mark Diddy, if I can bring you back in on it. I mean, you know, from what Alan says there, and certainly the research is there to support the fact that emigration can be very good for the individual and indeed for the Irish economy. What are you seeing of it, though, in rural Ireland?
Well, it's devastating in rural Ireland. I mean, entire football teams are emigrating. And you could have nine guys on a football team going to Australia on any given day. And
I suppose you might say they might be coming to Dublin if they weren't going to Australia, though.
Well, I would at least they'd be able to go home at the weekend, and I suppose the economics are one element of it. But the surprising thing about the economics of people who are emigrating, only one in five was unemployed when they left. 47% of them had a third level degree when they were leaving. And, you know, some of them were leaving jobs. Most of them were leaving jobs. But it's the...
That raises huge questions about the labour market in Ireland, doesn't it? The quality of jobs that is available.
What jobs they had is a very interesting research that can be done. But when you look at it, it's the mental health issues and the effect it has on society, not only those who leave. So you had 64% of those who left found it far more difficult than they had ever expected. And these are young people who you'd think, you know, this will be no problem. 72% felt that they were homesick. Every once a month they felt very homesick, and then they have consequent mental health issues in the long run for not a huge cohort, but for some and unfortunately not a small amount of people, but it's the people back home. So the economics of it is one element, and yes, they might be better off when they come back, but when you have grandkids growing up in Australia and grandparents back home in Ireland, you just can't put an economic value on that.
Absolutely. So, but do you acknowledge that it's a multifaceted issue? It's not all bad, of course.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But I think the key element, you know, and I suppose the group that needs to be looked after the most and targeted the most, and that has been done for many years, decades now, is the forgotten Irish who left in the 50s and 60s, as others have talked about. And they're the ones that need the most support. And that is the support that has been targeted towards, in fact, most of the budget that goes to the Irish Abroad Unit is actually targeted towards England, even though most of the Irish overseas and our diaspora live in the United States, but it's where the target should go to those who need it the most. And that's where it is going. But it is very hard, as we know in this country, when it comes to the issue of mental health, to actually get to the people who need it. Now, trying to do that in another country, over in England or in Australia, is doubly difficult. And I think that goes back to Hugh's point earlier, is, well, what does success look like to the Department of Foreign Affairs when it comes to our Irish overseas?
So how do we measure the impact?
And there is
of this
no measurable. And there's a famous quote from the Harvard Business School.
Everybody wants to come in.
If it's not being measured, it's not being done. And that is what is missing in this document. There is nothing, no measurable in this. There's no review.
It's a very
review.
Fair point, Bernard. I mean, I've been through the document. I can't see how it is going to be measured. I mean, they're talking about reviewing the implementation of this policy after two
well,
years.
Well, Mark has been negative about it, but we'll give him a fool's pardon on that one. We
no,
won't
no,
have that
Bernard,
road.
I'm not
we'll,
being
we'll,
negative.
We'll go another
I'm just
route.
Pointing
we'll
out
another
the flaws
route.
In
we'll
the document that are being pointed
I
out by
a theory.
Others.
I have a theory about immigration. I think that people immigrate for different reasons. People immigrate when they have skills, and people immigrate because they have to immigrate. Tragically, that's always been the case. Our education system has expanded considerably, and we now have more people with skills who can compete in the international marketplace and do at a very high level. And when they return, they've honed their skills while away, and they apply them at home, and they're successful and very successful. But one of the things that I believe about it is this, that we tend to be negative in this country. We have a negative attitude to everything, virtually. And when we go abroad, I won't talk about the show now, but however, when we go abroad, we get a new lease of life. We see an open, competitive environment where everybody is lauded for their efforts and are admired for their efforts. Now, that's a new thing to the Irish. Because
Brendan, I'm sure there are many people listening this evening to those comments that, you know, it's negative here that we go abroad. Mothers, fathers whose children cannot get home to work.
We know all about that.
Extolling the virtues of immigration.
We know all about that. But at some stage, we must recognise some kind of progress. And there's been huge progress in relation to the creation of jobs at home, in our home marketplace, against all the odds.
I'm joined on the line here by Liam Doran from the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation. Liam, thank you for joining us this evening. What's your reaction to that idea that emigration, you know, it can open the mind, it can broaden the horizons?
Oh, I'm incredulous of what I've just heard from Bernard there about suggesting that the emigration is positive and we're always negative. I'll tell you what's the real world. Is that in the last 4 years that have been measured, 2010, 11, 12, 13, this country lost almost 7,000 nurses. None of them went, or most of them didn't go because they wanted to. They went because there was no work for them in Ireland. We've now woken up in the last 3 or 4 months, I have to say, to a realization that we haven't got enough nurses in this country, and we're now desperately trying to find ways to bring them back. Now, I just heard Alan say that there's, I think he said, you know, research showing 7 to 10% pay plus about foreign experience coming back home. There's no experience. There's no add-on salary for a public sector nurse in Ireland when they return. In fact, we haven't yet woken up to the realization that our near neighbours are enticing our Irish nurses as we speak. Starting tomorrow, there's a recruitment fair for the Avon Health Trust from Britain. I think on Thursday they're in Dublin. They're offering €3,000 sign-on bonus to nurses to post them out of Ireland. We're desperately short. I just can't imagine the country and the circumstance that, with respect, Bernard is describing there in the context of what Irish nurses have had to face in the last 4 or 5 years.
You said there 7,000 nurses have left the country over the course of the downturn. That they're your figures. What does it cost to educate a nurse here in Ireland?
About the last figure, including the salary paid for that 36 weeks in the fourth year, about 80,000 over the 4 years. We had 1,596 seek to go away in 13, 1,591 in 12, 2,059 in 11, and 1,356 in 10. They're people who sought what we call certificates of verification, which they require to register their nursing qualification in the receiving country. They have to pay for that. So it's fairly well to assume that they're not getting it for any other reason other than using it. They went because there was no work here in Ireland, and there is no, you know, there's no positive when they return because there's no premium for overseas experience. The labour market doesn't work like that in the public sector. Ireland has got to compete now, and I have to say policymakers haven't yet woken up in this country to the fact that our near neighbours, let alone Australia and America, are paying nurses far more than the Irish growing, recovering economy is.
So you're talking about a cost of hundreds of millions of education, it cost us to educate these nurses that have gone, and we are now short on nurses. Mary Claire, you wanted to come in on that.
Yeah, I would like to support that point that Liam put forward, because if we look at the most recent CSO figures on return, we're seeing the lowest rate of return of Irish nationals since 1996. So I think, yes, it's very significant. 11,700 emigrants returned in the last year. So I think this really does, as Liam say, raise questions for policymakers. I mean, a lot of young people are going abroad. They're attracted by very attractive salaries, job opportunities, and the reasons they left. I mean, when we look at the fact that the majority left, full-time employment or were students prior to departure, we're seeing a significant brain drain. And, it's a global economy. There's, you know, fierce international competition for these skills, and we're going to see these skills shortages. And it's not just the nursing profession, although that has been particularly affected by emigration. We are seeing it in construction. Looking at the CSO applications the other day, we see young people opting for construction courses. But the UCC study found that 17% of emigrants who left were in construction or construction-led industry professions. So I think this is something very significant. And although the global diaspora policy acknowledges the barriers, we really need something more concrete, I think.
What do we need? What do you think would facilitate immigrants?
Well, when we spoke to immigrants just 6 months ago at a conference, they highlighted some of the deterrents to return. These are people that look at what's going on in Leinster House on a daily basis. And they said they were concerned that particularly those who may be returning with families about the housing situation, the high cost of living, the high health insurance and poor infrastructure. They talked about the need to have job opportunities outside Dublin and the need to foster investment in the regions. And they also talked about high taxes and, you know, the cost of living. So I think it's about taking on board those messages and putting in place some sort of package that will support and encourage immigrants to come back. Because I think what we're hearing from immigrants is, you know, we need something more concrete to return to.
Hugh, you wanted to come in.
Yeah, I think one of the things that Michael Noonan has been talking about in recent weeks, so certainly people in the Department of Finance, is that they, about perhaps aligning the tax system a bit more with, say, countries where immigrants have gone, so, you know, the UK and Canada and Australia, because that might tempt them back. That's one of the kind of proposals being talked about in government circles. But just on a wider point, though, someone asked me the other day, you know, is Ireland, you know, a case in point that austerity works, that austerity has worked, the austerity project and, you know, the Troika experiment in this country? And I think to some extent it has, but only because of the specific circumstances of Ireland whereby we have this release of people, where we've had 250,000 people leave the country since the onset of the crisis. And that has effectively ensured, well, not ensured, but certainly helped, you know, the government in being able to implement the sort of cuts that it's had to implement over the last few years. But at the same time, the economy is growing now and jobs are being created. So, I mean, I think that's a very unique set of circumstances. We don't have, as Alan referred to, this kind of lost generation in this country. We don't have as high a level of youth unemployment as they do in, say, Portugal or Spain.
Bernard, I mean, to bring you in, I mean, that is a really key point that Marie-Claire has made there, that the level of returning immigrants is as low, it hasn't been as low since whatever, the early 90s. I mean, we heard Michael Noonan talking, I think it was last week, the week before, he said the era of austerity has come to an end. And yet, these people, we hear Liam talking about the nurses who are still leaving the country, even though we're still paying for them to be educated. We're not doing enough to get them back.
I think Liam Dorn, I think, misconstrued what I had to say, because I didn't say what he suggested at all. I said that different people immigrated for different reasons, and they do, and different people come back to the country. But I would point out as well that the population of the country is higher now than it ever was in the last 100 years or so. So a considerable number of people have come back already. And you're right about the housing situation. The housing situation is desperate at the present time, and that is a factor that we have to deal with, for the simple reason that people coming home. I remember meeting people in Boston, New York, back in the early 90s, and they wanted to come home at the time. And the first thing they inquired about was, could they buy a home? And unfortunately, during the boom, that went outside of the reach of most people. And we still stuck with that overhang, as it were, in terms of values. But the point about it is this.
Everybody
is
wants to come in and they
are. The point I wanted to finish on that one is this, is they will come back. And don't forget this. People left because we didn't have the money to keep them here. We had to have budgetary cuts. And for those who suggest that it could be done otherwise, I would love to know. I invite people to come along and tell us where we were supposed to get
the money.
It was a terrible thing to visit the people of Ireland.
The way you're talking about it is that they had no choice to leave. So is that okay that in circumstances where we have to make budget cuts that we've made over the last few years, that, like, it's just going to have to be the way it is that we're going to have to let 250,000 people leave the country?
No, I believe that if we develop our economy properly and we don't have the peaks and troughs. Don't have the peaks and troughs that we've lived with for the last 50 years.
But history shows that we always have in this country. I mean, it's not going to be a Fine Gael Labour government
forever. Bernard is going to defy the laws of economics.
Well, I tell you, the law of economics, you guys set it up for the people of this country for the most awful fault that they ever had.
Bernard will answer this.
this question, and it's specifically in relation to nursing, because we train 7,000 nurses and we've trained them to leave, and Bernard seems to think that's okay because they'll get experience elsewhere. But we also
it was your government actually that created the situation.
Hundreds of millions of euros every year to take on agency nurses, and the government don't seem to be able to square the circle and say, well, why are we allowing so many nurses to leave and then paying agencies so much money to hire nurses when they should be hired full time and be in the INO and be part of the health service that will solve the problems in the A&E, try and get the 800 people who are tonight inside in an acute hospital where they shouldn't be and should be in a step-down facility, either a nursing home or somewhere else. And yet the government seemed to say,
but your government
okay,
was doing that during the boom.
Okay, hang on. We still have Liam Doran on the line. Liam, anything you've heard here that to make you think that maybe a nurse won't leave tomorrow? I think it's the Avon Trust, is it?
Yes.
From the NHS are over in Cork tomorrow. Looking for Irish nurses.
I have grey hair, but I have greyer hair listening to the two lads. I mean, with trying to be apolitical about it, the recruitment embargo for nursing was first introduced by the previous government, not the current government. So all parties provided a passport and an exit visa for nurses for the last 6 or 7 years. What seems to have been lost by all the policymakers is they've just forgotten the world is a smaller place. Just because we're now recovering, this is all about manpower planning. It's all about realising. We had no difficulty in letting nurses go, even though we have an ageing demographics, even though we have an increasing population, as Bernard has said, which demand healthcare. We had no problem in letting these nurses go because we thought somehow or other, when we flicked a switch, they'd all come coming back. They won't. And we're now in a desperate state of affairs where there is a, and I have to say, there is a genuine attempt now to try and initiate recruitment. But we're fighting against a very high tidal wave. Avon Plus is just the latest one. There was another recruitment agency last month offering a plethora of, if you like, carrots to try and bring people over from this country to England. And England is now much closer than it was. I mean, you can get home at weekends for 1999, the same way as 30 years ago you went to the civil service of the bank in Dublin from Cork or Limerick and you came home at weekends. You can literally do that now from the UK because of the way air travel has gone and so on.
So it's going to be harder to get them home.
We have just missed that point. Mm-hmm. The era of austerity has crippled our health service. We didn't plan, and nurses won't just come back because suddenly Ireland is calling them. They'll only come back when their pay and conditions match to what's being offered to them in our near neighbours, let alone Australia and Canada.
OK, yeah. Well, listen, Liam Doran, thank you very much indeed for joining us. We're going to have to move on from this topic. We've had a lot of reaction to it from our listeners. Con Foley says, why can't Bernard just say the reason why the mainstream parties don't want immigrants to vote? They're afraid of the results. Another person, Larry Donnelly, I've lived in Ireland for 13 years. He's never missed a vote. Larry Donnelly, of course, in the US elections. He says national identity is bigger than tax liability. It's a fair point. Another person, I've lived in Canada since 1967. And as much as I would welcome the privilege of being allowed to exercise my vote as an Irish citizen, I do strongly agree that I shouldn't have representation without taxation. There are plenty more comments on this. But actually, at this point, we're going to move on to we're going to talk about an Irish citizen who is stuck abroad. Ibrahim Halawa has now been in jail in Cairo since August 2013 and there are new fears for his safety after the first execution of a pro-Morsi protester. He's been charged with murder, attempted murder and participating in an illegal protest. Halawa's cellmate Peter Grest was released last month and shortly afterwards Halawa smuggled a letter out of jail saying that he believed that the Irish government was not working hard enough to secure his release. Well, Senator Mark Daly, I know you've been looking at this case. Just outline for us, what are the new fears for his safety now currently?
Well, I suppose we've seen the first execution in relation to the disturbances 2 years ago, which Ibrahim was caught up in, and he is on trial along with 494 other people. His solicitor cannot even get permission to attend the hearings because such is the scale of the court case. His next trial date is coming up on the 29th, and of course, with the execution, it puts renewed focus on the situation. And what we have seen is active engagement by other governments. We have seen the Australian Prime Minister pick up the phone and ring President Sisi in Egypt and request, as is allowed under Egyptian law, and a presidential decree was brought into place in November 2014 specifically to allow non-Egyptian citizens to be released and sent back. But you have to ask, And the Irish government have failed to ask. They've skirted around.
Well, let me bring Bernard in. I mean, have we asked? Are we intending
to
ask?
That's entirely untrue. Entirely untrue.
I didn't know in actual fact,
everything is not done by phone calls. It might happen in some quarters, but we don't rely on phone calls all the time. The Minister for Foreign Affairs has been actively engaged right from the outset, and it is understandable that the person incarcerated will feel that there isn't enough reaction to their particular case. I could tell you more about that as well, but I won't tonight. But the point I want to make there is this. Every single thing that could be done is being done on a daily basis. And the minister, in fact, in the last few days, in the last week, met the deputy minister in Brussels, I think, and he issued a statement afterwards. Every possible matter that can be pursued.
But the Australian Prime Minister got involved in this. Well, has Enda Kenny got involved in this?
There are reasons and reasons. First of all, the Egyptian authorities believe this young man has dual citizenship. We don't agree, and the minister has pointed that out to the Egyptian authorities. He has only ever had an Irish passport. He has an Irish passport, and in fact, he had to apply for a visa to gain entry to Egypt in the first place. He's the only member of his family who has that particular status. Apparently, that's not accepted by the Egyptian authorities, and it is not seen as the same as the Australian situation at all.
So that's the key difference.
And they're
saying that he has
Egyptian citizenship. So they're suggesting that because a person is born into an Egyptian family, even outside the country, he was born in this country.
But just to be very clear, Brenda, I know you want to come in here. Yeah. Has the Taoiseach picked up the phone?
In the first instance, the Taoiseach would have discussed this with his colleagues at various European Council meetings, because this issue has been brought up on numerous occasions. The Minister for Foreign Affairs is the person with the responsibility for that particular portfolio.
No,
And no, it's not a question of yes or no.
No, just has he made that call?
Just because Senator Daly suddenly came up with a bright idea that a phone call was going to solve this problem.
The Australians were
in a different situation with a different status altogether.
Okay, let you come in on this. I know you've been working on this.
There's a couple of things, Bernard. You, a man of your experience, knows that a phone call from the Irish Prime Minister to his Egyptian counterpart carries far more weight than a phone call from the Irish Foreign Minister to his Egyptian counterpart or other such phone calls. So there's that point. There's another issue as well, I think, in terms of, you know, maybe the media are at fault to some extent here as well, in that we've kind of forgotten about the Halawa case, being brutally honest.
It's true, it goes off
it's
the
true.
Agenda, doesn't
and
it?
And the difference with the Australia case with Peter Greste was that was kept on the agenda for months and months and months, and I think that's primarily because he was a journalist and media like talking about media. Let's be brutally honest here. If he was an engineer, there wouldn't be as much media interest as there was and as much of a campaign as there was to get him out, and ultimately I think that's what did it. But I think it is a crucial point. You know, maybe it's an idea that's only come into existence in the last few days, this idea that the Taoiseach should make an intervention here, but certainly something to that effect would have far more of an impact than, no disrespect to the Minister of Foreign Affairs, than him doing it. So, you know, perhaps that's something you should raise with the Taoiseach, Bernard.
Well, in actual fact, every effort is being made as we speak, and I reject entirely the suggestion, you know, that only the Taoiseach can resolve the problem.
But it's part of the process. It's part of a suite of things that could be done.
It may well have been done.
Mark Dale, I'll give you the final word on this.
Bernard doesn't seem to know whether
case.
It was done or not, but Amnesty International are quite clear that Ibrahim has no case to answer. He's entirely innocent of any charges being brought against him. And we've got to do with what works. And what works is what worked with the Australians. There was a presidential decree brought in November 2014, specifically to assist any foreign national who was charged with a criminal offence to be deported.
Literally. Mark, you did mention Amnesty there, and you'd have to say that Colin McGorman from Amnesty has said that the Department of Foreign Affairs has been doing everything possible, that many crucial steps have not been made public.
But I can tell you this, the Taoiseach did not pick up the phone.
Do you know?
But Bernard, I'll tell you this.
Do you know?
He has not picked up the phone.
Listen, you don't know if he hasn't picked up the phone.
If you can clarify that, if he could pick up the phone, he would have got the same success as the Prime Minister of Australia.
Okay,
the Prime Minister of Australia succeeded. Are you saying that the Prime Minister of Australia...
Let Bernard in
here. Yours is the new version of diplomacy. Anyway, we won't go there for a second. He and his three sisters were detained following incidents
Do you know what, Bernard? We're going back into the inner workings of the case.
The sisters were released.
Not following intervention by the Taoiseach.
No, they were released.
Okay, we're going to leave this story.
This young man was detained. It isn't as simple as it looks, and I can assure you that even as we speak, every effort is being made to bring about his release.
All right, now you have made that point. Okay, it's 4 years almost to the day since the current Fine Gael Labour coalition took office. 4 years ago, unemployment stood at over 14%. People seem to be genuinely fearful about the future of the country. Now, while many are still struggling, we're talking about emigration, we're still seeing food queues and growing numbers of home repossessions, but the macroeconomic picture does seem to have improved. Hugh, as a political correspondent, how have they done? What's the report card? We heard Enda Kenny talking about report cards for the ministers when he took office 4 years ago. How would you rate him
and
his government?
Let me do what the Taoiseach didn't do. Let's give it a grade. Let's say C+. Okay? So the economy obviously has been a big success story for this government. And particularly if you look at the first 3 years of this government, it implemented all of the things that the Troika told them to implement or didn't in some cases but was kind of told off for that. But if you look in the kind of big picture in terms of turning the economy around and creating employment, they've done that, and they've done that very successfully, I think. And I think you can't begrudge them that. But they've done it at an enormous social cost when you think about inequality in this country, when you think about the homelessness crisis, when you think about families up and down the country who've been really badly affected by what's happened over the last 6 or 7 years. And also when you think about the recovery, it's sort of two-tier, where you have Dublin and other metropolitan areas have benefited very well from the recovery and of showing signs of recovery. There's been huge growth in these areas. But rural Ireland has been really badly impacted. I come from a small enough town in South Kildare, which every second shop is closed. I'm not going to say which one. But, it's... you're seeing that in some parts of the country, it's not the recovery isn't translating there. Now, that's in the first 3 years. So, but if you look at last year, 2014, the Troika left and government descended, I think, into chaos last year when you think about it. Between the medical card crisis, which was entirely avoidable, but they just steamed ahead anyway.
And, were the discretionary medical card.
The changes they tried to implement, it was a very brutal system, and they acknowledged that they made a big mistake there, and they paid for it in the local and European elections. And then if you look at, obviously, Irish Water was a huge disaster last year from January to December. You had in January John Tierney saying €50 million was spent on consultants, and then in December, finally they seem to sort of sorted it out in terms of introducing a much different charging regime to the one that had been proposed. And obviously you had all the Garda scandals, controversies, which forced the Minister for Justice to resign. And of course we had the departure in very mysterious circumstances of Martin Callanan, and that remains ongoing. On the economic side, the government's done a very good job, I think. But on the kind of the other issues, and particularly we saw last year with all the controversies there, it hasn't done so well. And that's why its support has been impacted in the polls, I think. I think going into 2015, if they can keep the message on the economy and if more people can start feeling the recovery, then it stands a decent chance of being re-elected next year. But it only takes another controversy or maybe something out of the Fenley Commission for the Taoiseach. If it's bad news there for him, that could be a whole big scandal.
Alan Barrett, I mean, on the economic, some would say turnaround, I suppose, the country has been through. I mean, not for a moment to disregard those who are still struggling, but how good a job or bad a job do you think has been done?
Well, can I just say you're doing a good job keeping the politicians out of it for a minute or two, so we give credit where it's due. I think on the macroeconomics, the government does deserve credit. I don't think a number of years ago anybody would have thought, if you take the unemployment rate, to get it down from 15% down to essentially close to 10% over a 4-year period. I mean, that is quite a remarkable achievement. In terms of the management of the public finances, austerity has been very, very hard on people. Mm. We can debate as to whether or not there was any alternative. But I mean, the real problem was the economy. People suffered because the economy collapsed. Yeah. You know, austerity, again, in a sense, was partly a symptom of it. There wasn't really a way around it. But I think there was very clever management of the public finances. I mean, the government continually sort of set targets and budgets, and then they exceeded the targets. So there was a sort of a sense that they were really getting ahead of the situation. And my former colleague John Fitzgerald has often pointed out that the Spanish government did something quite different. They set targets and they continually missed them. So it's always expectation.
You think that was all thought through?
No, quite seriously. And as a member of the Fiscal Council, I sort of keep a close eye on the management of the public finances, and I think they did a very good job. Back to the point about diplomacy.
Alan, you could ask, did they do the very good job, or had that those kind of rules, many of them, been set in stone by the Troika?
I think they did sort of do a good job, because I think they sort of were conservative in some of the projections that they were putting out, and as a result they were just making sure that things were going to work out. There's often a temptation in government that you're overly optimistic and you're putting the best foot forward, but I think they were good on that. Just on sort of economic diplomacy, the negotiation on the promissory note was a great success. There was also the negotiations around the interest rate. I mean, again, these were things that I think vastly exceeded people's expectations, and the positives of that were quite enormous. The ongoing problems are that still unemployment at 10% is too high.
Yeah, that's true. We're all talking about it's down to 10%. It's still very significant.
Well, I think, again, we have to be careful sort of in saying that it is still very, very high, and there's still an enormous challenge there. And the home, I mean, this is something that Troika even talked about when they were here. The mortgage issue is still there and is going to get an awful lot worse in terms of sort of repossessions in the coming months. So a lot done. But whatever that phrase
a lot more
to
do. Okay, Mark Daly, you're taking it. I'm sure you're just dying to congratulate Bernard and his government on their huge successes over the last 4 years.
I got to say that Enda Kenny grading himself is a bit like the student giving himself his own marks. And I suppose if you live in Dublin 4 or 6 and you read enough of the newspapers and tell you everything's going well and things aren't too bad for you, then you probably believe it. But outside of the bubble of Leinster House and South Dublin in rural Ireland, and for those who are about to have their homes repossessed, it's not going as well. And when you see the social welfare cuts, when you see the fact that one in eight children in Ireland are now living in poverty, that's a statistic that the government aren't putting up on their grade sheets, and they're the real facts. And people, how many people now are struggling, and how many people this time next year will have lost their houses. And the grade is in the opinion polls. Politicians say they don't take much notice of them, but actually the government's grade isn't that. And in fact, Labour's grade
isn't doing too badly.
Well, Labour's grade, I suppose, is the one where they overpromised and underdelivered, unlike what my colleague said.
Okay, Mary Carey, you want to come in?
But just finally, and when they did say Labour's way or Frankfurt's way, that has gone the way of Gilmore for Taoiseach, and they will get their answer at the next general election. They will get their
Labour, you're pointing at here, is going to take the flak on it. Mary Carey,
I agree with Hugh and Alan on the economic side. We've seen a decline in the numbers of people leaving, we've seen a reduction in unemployment, but the figures on youth unemployment are still extremely high, and we still have a very high proportion of young people that are not in any form of education, training or employment. So I think it's at a cost, and austerity has been quite cruel, particularly to young people, and we're going to see a legacy, unfortunately.
And certainly that's people are getting in touch with us. What about health, education, mortgage debts, child poverty? This is a society, not an economy. I mean, Bernard, clearly the figures are there. There has been improvement to the macroeconomic picture. Do you think it's been good enough? Do you think it has reached out to
There's
enough
Irish citizens? Huge transformation of the position as to where we were and where we are now. The national economic wagon was buried in the ditch, barely visible from the point of view of passers-by. And to think that the country has recovered, it was a terrible hit on all of the people. Massive sacrifices made by people. And we didn't know, nobody knew, none of us at any level in society knew what was around the corner next. And I remember waking up mornings during the first 2 years of the life of the present government and wondering what was going to come around the corner next, because we didn't know. And it's all very fine to say nowadays, that it was austerity. What alternatives were there. When a household is short of money, when somebody has no money to pay the bills, what do they do? Do they borrow more money? Or where were we going to borrow it? Remember, we were borrowing it almost 15% when we took over. Almost 15%. Immigration, rife. Unemployment, rife. Everything was collapsing. And all this thing about the mortgages and everything was there then at that particular time as well. And growing. And back as far as 2008. And I would simply say this. I think the Irish people have done a great job in pulling the economy together again.
Huge.
But they got leadership as well. And leadership was missing before that.
Okay. Yeah.
And if you don't have leadership, we're going nowhere.
Okay.
And I would compliment both for what they've done.
Well, one thing I would say, and it's to Bernard and to Mark as well, is that ultimately this government, I think, has implemented much of what the four-year plan that Fianna Fáil laid out in 2009, 2010. But not, of course, counting the promissory note, which is a significant deal, and also those other debt savings and a reduction in the interest rate. Now, they were achievements by this government, no doubt about it. But in terms of the kind of the stuff that was laid out in the four-year plan, a lot of that is what the government's implemented. And I know you're going to bring up water charges as well.
But
then I would put that to Mark Mark, you know, what grade ultimately would you give this government for implementing much of what was in Fianna Fáil's four-year plan?
They didn't lay it out in the first place. They claim credit for it now, because what happened, the first is there were three attempts made, there were three attempts made, just in case that this was missed, in 2007, after the general election in 2007, there were three attempts made to make some effort in bringing the country back into the straight and narrow flight path again, and they failed.
Okay,
Government of the day what was lacking and what had to be done. And Fianna Fáil then claim now that they implemented,
I think it's interesting that Bernard talks about the Troika, because 60% of the necessity and the cuts that were made were done under the Fianna Fáil budgets, unfortunately. And the new Irish Troika, which is made up of four people in the cabinet, are the ones that are in charge. And when they took over from the European Troika, they made an absolute hames out of it. And they mismanaged everything from the medical cards all the way through to the social welfare cuts that they were implementing on special needs. And then they're giving medical cards to billionaires and millionaires, children under 5.
So what
you
guys were saying in 2007?
Well, Bernard, if you can agree to giving millionaires children's medical cards and taking them off those who
Bernard,
are special needs,
the
then you're
everywhere.
On the wrong
it's
side
not,
of the track.
Hang on a sec. Listen,
people.
Just hold on there, Mark. The real key, as you say, Mark, as to how the government has done, is how they do in the next election. And part of that is going to be whatever giveaway can be done in the next budget. Alan, I'm just looking at the Examiner, tomorrow's Examiner there. There's a headline, Noonan seeks extra $1.5 billion but faces ECB opposition. Mm. Basically, that he could have an extra $1.5 billion to spend in this year's budget, but he might not get to do so because of opposition from the ECB. I mean, that would be, an economic but political disaster.
He's trying to buy the next election.
Well, he's actually...
Is it likely that he could be stopped?
It's a really interesting development. I mean, the fiscal rules now determine the boundaries of fiscal policy. Essentially, what Michael Noonan is recognising the fact that the certain countries in Europe are getting a bit of a pass when it comes to fiscal rules, the French in particular. He is basically sort of saying, and we'd all expected this, well, if they're getting an easier ride, can we, the Irish, get an easier ride? But in fairness to him, he's combining it with a sort of a good argument, which is rather dry, but it's about the measurement of this thing called structural deficits and potential output. You don't need to know that. But the point about it is that he's not just playing, he's not just sort of, going in with a strong-headed political point. He's backing it up with a technical point, which suggests that, he might be right to argue for a little bit of extra leeway. So,
but it seems that he's getting significant opposition from the ECB.
He may well get significant support from people like the French.
Okay, listen, the headline there in the Irish Examiner is drug cases in doubt after the key ruling. The Court of Appeal rules Misuse of Drugs Act is unconstitutional. I know that we're talking about that in the Dáil tonight. And we'll just have a quick look at the Independent before we go. Their headline, Sinn Féin in crisis over new IRA sex abuse claim. Taoiseach Joan Burton has accused Sinn Féin of orchestrating a crisis in Northern Ireland to distract from the latest damaging allegations of IRA sex abuse cover-ups.
The proof that Minister Noonan is buying the next election is actually in one of the paragraphs. He told the government meeting of ministers that I'm facing an election. I do not want to be treated with derision by my electorate.
On that note, we're going to leave it.
I won't even bother.
Listen, thank you all very much indeed.
I'm glad
for
you admitted defeat, Bernard. Thanks for participating.
I could ask you the question as to where the government was when you fight your first arrived in the country.
Professor Alan Barrett, Mary Claire McAleer, Senator Mark Daly, Hugh O'Connell, and Bernard Durkin. Thank you very much. We'll be back with you tomorrow night at 10.